Scores of the black things had now appeared, and Laurel understood that soon there would be hundreds, thousands, millions, billions. Even with the jet engine screaming through the open forward door as Brian pulled the 767 away from the ladder in the wing of the Delta jet, she could hear their yammering, inhuman cry. Great looping coils of blackness crisscrossed the end of runway 21, and then the tracks narrowed toward the terminal, converging as the bulls making them rushed toward Craig Toomey. I guess they don't get live meat very often, she thought, and suddenly felt like vomiting. Nick Hopewell slammed the forward door after one final unbelieving glance and dogged it shut. He began to stagger back down the aisle, swaying from side to side like a drunk as he came. His eyes seemed to fill his whole face. Blood streamed down his chin. He had bitten his lower lip deeply. He put his arms around Laurel and buried his burning face in the hollow where her neck met her shoulder. She put her arms around him and held him tight. In the cockpit, Brian powered up as fast as he dared and sent the 767 charging along the taxiway at a suicidal rate of speed. The eastern edge of the airport was now black with the invading balls. The end of runway 21 had completely disappeared and the world beyond it was going. In that direction, the white, unmoving sky now arched down over a world of scrawled black lines and fallen trees. As the plane neared the end of the taxiway, Brian grabbed the microphone and shouted, "Belt in! Belt in! If you're not belted in, hold on!" He slowed marginally, then slewed the 767 onto runway 33. As he did so, he saw something which made his mind cringe and wail. Huge sections of the world which lay to the east of the runway, huge irregular pieces of reality itself, were falling into the ground like freight elevators, leaving big, senseless chunks of emptiness behind. They are eating the world, he thought. My God, my dear God, they are eating the world. Then the entire airfield was turning in front of him, and Flight 29 was pointed west again, with runway 33 lying open and long and deserted before it. Overhead compartments burst open when the 767 swerved onto the runway, spraying carry-on luggage across the main cabin in a deadly hail. Bethany, who hadn't had time to fasten her seatbelt, was hurled into Albert Costner's lap. Albert noticed neither his lap full of warm girl nor the attaché case that caromed off the curved wall 3 feet in front of his nose. He saw only the dark, speeding shapes rushing across runway 21 to the left of them and the glistening dark tracks they left behind. These tracks converged in a giant well of blackness where the luggage unloading area had been. They are being drawn to Mr. Toomey, he thought, or to where Mr. Toomey was. If he hadn't come out of the terminal, they would have chosen the airplane instead. They would have eaten it, and us inside it from the wheels up. Behind him, Bob Jenkins spoke in a trembling, awed voice. Now we know, don't we? What? Laurel screamed in an odd, breathless voice she did not recognize as her own. A duffel bag landed in her lap. Nick raised his head, let go of her, and batted it absently into the aisle. What do we know? Why, what happens today when it becomes yesterday? What happens to the present when it becomes the past? It waits, dead and empty and deserted. It waits for them. It waits for the timekeepers of eternity, always running along behind, cleaning up the mess in the most efficient way possible, by eating it.
Mr. Toomey knew about them, Dinah said in a clear, dreaming voice. Mr. Toomey says they are the Langoliers.
Then the jet engine cycled up to full power and the plane charged down runway 33. Brian saw two of the balls zip across the runway ahead of him, peeling back the surface of reality in a pair of parallel tracks which gleamed like polished ebony. It was too late to stop. The 767 shuddered like a dog with a chill as it raced over the empty places, but he was able to hold it on the runway. He shoved his throttles forward, burying them, and watched his ground speed indicator rise toward the commit point. Even now, he could hear those manic chewing, gobbling sounds, although he did not know if they were in his ears or only his reeling mind, and did not care. Leaning over Laurel to look out the window, Nick saw the Bangor International Terminal sliced, diced, chopped, and channeled. It tottered in its various jigsaw pieces and then began to tumble into loony chasms of darkness. Bethany Sims screamed. A black track was speeding along next to the 767, chewing up the edge of the runway. Suddenly, it jagged to the right and disappeared underneath the plane. There was another terrific bump.
Did it get us? Nick shouted. Did it get us?
No one answered him. Their pale, terrified faces stared out the windows and no one answered him. Trees rushed by in a gray-green blur. In the cockpit, Brian sat tensely forward in his seat, waiting for one of those balls to bounce up in front of the cockpit window and bullet through. None did. On his board, the last red lights turned green. Brian hauled back on the yoke, and the 767 was airborne again. In the main cabin, a black-bearded man with bloodshot eyes staggered forward, blinking owlishly at his fellow travelers.
"Are we almost in Boston yet?"
he inquired at large.
"I hope so, because I want to go back to bed. I've got one bastard of a headache."
The plane banked heavily east, throwing the man with the black beard into a row of empty seats three-quarters of the way up the main cabin. He looked around at all the other empty seats with a wide, frightened gaze and squeezed his eyes shut.
"Jesus,"
he muttered.
"DTs, fucking DTs. This is the worst they've ever been."
He looked around fearfully.
"The bugs come next. Where's the motherfucking bugs?"
No bugs, Albert thought. But wait till you see the balls. You're gonna love those.
"Buggy yourself in, mate," Nick said. "And shut up!"
He broke off, staring down incredulously at the airport, or where the airport had been. The main buildings were gone, and the National Guard base at the West End was going. Flight 29 overflew a growing abyss of darkness, an eternal cistern that seemed to have no end.
"Oh, dear Jesus, Nick,"
Laurel said unsteadily, and suddenly put her hands over her eyes. As they overflew runway 33, at 1,500 feet, Nick saw 60 or 100 parallel lines racing up the concrete, cutting the runway into long strips that sank into emptiness. The strips reminded him of Craig Toomey.
Rip!
On the other side of the aisle, Bethany pulled down the window shade beside Albert's seat with a bang.
"Don't you dare open that,"
she told him in a scolding, hysterical voice. "Don't worry," Albert said, and suddenly remembered that he had left his violin down there. Well, it was undoubtedly gone now. He abruptly put his hands over his own face. Before Brian began to turn west again, he saw what lay east of Bangor. It was nothing. Nothing at all. A titanic river of blackness lay in a still sweep from horizon to horizon under the white dome of the sky. The trees were gone. The city was gone. The earth itself was gone. This is what it must be like to fly in outer space, he thought. And he felt his rationality slip a cog, as it had on the trip east. He held on to himself desperately and made himself concentrate on flying the plane. He brought them up quickly, wanting to be in the clouds, wanting that hellish vision to be blotted out. Then Flight 29 was pointed west again. In the moments before they entered the clouds, he saw the hills and woods and lakes which stretched to the west of the city, saw them being cut ruthlessly apart by thousands of black spiderweb lines. He saw huge swatches of reality go sliding soundlessly into the growing mouth of the abyss. And Brian did something he had never done before while in the cockpit of an airplane. He closed his eyes. When he opened them again, they were in the clouds. There was almost no turbulence this time, as Bob Jenkins had suggested. The weather patterns appeared to be running down like an old clock. 10 minutes after entering the clouds, Flight 29 emerged into the bright blue world which began at 18,000 feet. The remaining passengers looked around at each other nervously, then at the speakers as Brian came on the intercom.
"We're up," he said simply. "You all know what happens now. We go back exactly the way we came and hope that whatever doorway we came through is still there. If it is, we'll try going through."
He paused for a moment, then resumed. "Our return flight is going to take somewhere between 4.5 and 6 hours. I'd like to be more exact, but I can't. Under ordinary circumstances, the flight west usually takes longer than the flight east because of prevailing wind conditions. But so far as I can tell from my cockpit instruments, there is no wind." Brian paused for a moment and then added, "There's nothing moving up here but us." For a moment, the intercom stayed on, as if Brian meant to add something else, and then it clicked off.
"What in God's name is going on here?"
the man with the black beard asked shakily. Albert looked at him for a moment and then said, "I don't think you want to know."
"Am I in the hospital again?"
The man with the black beard blinked at Albert fearfully, and Albert felt sudden sympathy for him. "Well, why don't you believe you are, if it will help?" The man with the black beard continued to stare at him for a moment in dreadful fascination and then announced,
I'm going back to sleep right now.
He reclined his seat and closed his eyes. In less than a minute, his chest was moving up and down with deep regularity, and he was snoring under his breath. Albert envied him. Nick gave Laurel a brief hug, then unbuckled his seatbelt and stood up.
I'm going forward, he said. Want to come?
Laurel shook her head and pointed across the aisle at Dinah. I'll stay with her.
There's nothing you can do, you know, Nick said. It's in God's hands now, I'm afraid.
I do know that, she said, but I want to stay.
All right, Laurel.
He brushed at her hair gently with the palm of his hand.
It's such a pretty name. You deserve it.
She glanced up at him and smiled. Thank you.
We have a dinner date. You haven't forgotten, have you?
No, she said, still smiling. I haven't and I won't. He bent down and brushed a kiss lightly across her mouth.
Good, he said. Neither will I.
He went forward and she pressed her fingers lightly against her mouth, as if to hold his kiss there, where it belonged. Dinner with Nick Hopewell, a dark, mysterious stranger. Maybe with candles and a good bottle of wine. More kisses afterward. Real kisses. It all seemed like something which might happen in one of those Harlequin romances she sometimes read. So what? There were pleasant stories, full of sweet and harmless dreams. It didn't hurt to dream a little, did it? Of course not. But why did she feel the dream was so unlikely to come true? She unbuckled her own seatbelt across the aisle and put her hand on the girl's forehead. The hectic heat she had felt before was gone. Dinah's skin was now waxy cool.
I think she's going,
Rudy had said shortly before they started their headlong takeoff charge. Now the words recurred to Laurel and rang in her head with sickening validity. Dinah was taking air in shallow sips, her chest barely rising and falling beneath the strap which cinched the tablecloth pad tight over her wound. Laurel brushed the girl's hair off her forehead with infinite tenderness and thought of that strange moment in the restaurant when Dinah had reached out and grasped the cuff of Nick's jeans.
Don't you kill him. We need him.
Did you save us, Dinah? Did you do something to Mr. Toomey that saved us? Did you make him somehow trade his life for ours? She thought that perhaps something like that had happened, and reflected that, if it was true, this little girl, blind and badly wounded, had made a dreadful decision inside her darkness. She leaned forward and kissed each of Dinah's cool, closed lids. Hold on, she whispered. Please hold on, Dinah. Bethany turned to Albert, grasped both of his hands in hers, and asked,
What happens if the fuel goes bad?
Albert looked at her seriously and kindly.
You know the answer to that, Bethany.
You can call me Beth if you want.
Okay. She fumbled out her cigarettes, looked up at the no-smoking light, and put them away again.
Yeah, she said. I know. We crash. End the story. And you know what?
He shook his head, smiling a little.
If we can't find that hole again, I hope Captain Engel won't even try to land the plane. I hope he just picks out a nice high mountain and crashes us into the top of it. Did you see what happened to that crazy guy? I don't want that to happen to me.
She shuddered, and Albert put an arm around her. She looked up at him frankly.
Would you like to kiss me?
Yes, Albert said.
Well, you better go ahead then. The later it gets, the later it gets.
Albert went ahead. It was only the third time in his life that the fastest Hebrew west of the Mississippi had kissed a girl. And it was great. He could spend the whole trip back in a lip lock with this girl and never worry about a thing.
Thank you, she said,
and put her head on his shoulder.
I needed that.
Well, if you need it again, just ask, Albert said. She looked up at him, amused.
Do you need me to ask, Albert?
I reckon not,
drawled the Arizona Jew, and went back to work. Nick had stopped on his way to the cockpit to speak to Bob Jenkins. An extremely nasty idea had occurred to him, and he wanted to ask the writer about it.
Do you think there could be any of those things up here? Bob thought it over for a moment. Judging from what we saw back at Bangor, I would think not. But it's hard to tell, isn't it? In a thing like this, all bets are off.
Yes, I suppose so. All bets are off. Nick thought this over for a moment. What about this time rip of yours? Would you like to give odds on us finding it again?
Bob Jenkins slowly shook his head. Rudy Warwick spoke up from behind them, startling them both.
You didn't ask me, but I'll give you my opinion just the same. I put them at 1 in 1,000.
Nick thought this over. After a moment, a rare, radiant smile burst across his face.
Not bad odds at all, he said. Not when you consider the alternative.
Less than 40 minutes later, the blue sky through which Flight 29 moved began to deepen in color. It cycled slowly to indigo and then to deep purple. Sitting in the cockpit, monitoring his instruments and wishing for a cup of coffee, Brian thought of an old song. When the deep purple falls over sleepy garden walls. No garden walls up here, but he could see the first ice chip stars gleaming in the firmament. There was something reassuring and calming about the old constellations appearing, one by one, in their old places. He did not know how they could be the same when so many other things were so badly out of joint, but he was very glad they were.
It's going faster, isn't it? Nick said from behind him.
Brian turned in his seat to face him. Yes, it is. After a while, the days and nights will be passing as fast as a camera shutter can click, I think. Nick sighed.
And now we do the hardest thing of all, don't we? We wait to see what happens. And pray a little bit, I suppose.
It couldn't hurt. Brian took a long, measuring look at Nick Hopewell. I was on my way to Boston because my ex-wife died in a stupid fire. Dinah was going because a bunch of doctors promised her a new pair of eyes. Bob was going to a convention, Albert to music school, Laurel on vacation. Why were you going to Boston, Nick? Fess up. The hour groweth late. Nick looked at him thoughtfully for a long time and then laughed.
Well, why not? He asked.
But Brian was not so foolish as to believe this question was directed at him.
What does a most secret classification mean when you've just seen a bunch of killer fuzzballs rolling up the world like an old rug?
He laughed again.
The United States hasn't exactly cornered the market on dirty tricks and covert operations, he told Brian. We Limers have forgotten more nasty mischief than you Johnnies ever knew.
We've cut capers in India, South Africa, China, and the part of Palestine which became Israel. We certainly got into a pissing contest with the wrong fellas that time, didn't we?
Nevertheless, we British are great believers in cloak and dagger, and the fabled MI5 isn't where it ends, but only where it begins. I spent 18 years in the armed services, Brian, the last 5 of them in special operations. Since then, I've done various odd jobs, some innocuous, some fabulously nasty.
It was full dark outside now, the stars gleaming like spangles on a woman's formal evening gown.
I was in Los Angeles, on vacation, actually, when I was contacted and told to fly to Boston. Extremely short notice, this was, and after 4 days spent backpacking in the San Gabriels, I was falling down tired. That's why I happened to be sound asleep when Mr. Jenkins's event happened. There's a man in Boston, you see, or was, or will be. Time travel plays hell on the old verb tenses, doesn't it? Who is a politician of some note. The sort of fellow who moves and shakes with great vigor behind the scenes. This man, I'll call him Mr. O'Banion for the sake of conversation, is very rich, Brian, and he is an enthusiastic supporter of the Irish Republican Army. He has channeled millions of dollars into what some like to call Boston's favorite charity, and there is a good deal of blood on his hands. Not just British soldiers, but children in schoolyards, women in laundrettes, and babies blown out of their prams in pieces. He is an idealist of the most dangerous sort. One who never has to view the carnage at first hand. One who has never had to look at a severed leg lying in the gutter and been forced to reconsider his actions in light of that experience. You were supposed to kill this man, O'Banion? Not unless I had to, Nick said calmly. He's very wealthy, but that's not the only problem.
He's the total politician, you see. And he's got more fingers than the one he uses to stir the pot in Ireland. He has a great many powerful American friends, and some of his friends are our friends. That's the nature of politics. A cat's cradle woven by men who, for the most part, belong in rooms with rubber walls. Killing Mr. O'Banion would be a great political risk. But he keeps a little bit of fluff on the side. She was the one I was supposed to kill. As a warning, Brian said in a low, fascinated voice. Yes, as a warning. Almost a full minute passed as the two men sat in the cockpit looking at each other. The only sound was the sleepy drone of the jet engines. Brian's eyes were shocked and somehow very young. Nick only looked weary. If we get out of this, Brian said at last, if we get back, will you carry through with it? Nick shook his head. He did this slowly, but with great finality. I believe I've had what the Adventist blokes like to call a soul conversion, old mate of mine. No more midnight creeps or extreme prejudice jobs for Mrs. Hopewell's boy, Nicholas. If we get out of this, a proposition I find rather shaky just now, I believe I'll retire.
And do what?
Nick looked at him thoughtfully for a moment or two and then said, well, I suppose I could take flying lessons.
Brian burst out laughing. After a moment, Mrs. Hopewell's boy, Nicholas, joined him. 35 minutes later, daylight began to seep back into the main cabin of Flight 29. 3 minutes later, it might have been mid-morning. 15 minutes after that, it might have been noon. Laurel looked around and saw that Dinah's sightless eyes were open. Yet were they entirely sightless? There was something in them, something just beyond definition, which made Laurel wonder. She felt a sense of unknown awe creep into her, a feeling which almost touched upon fear. She reached out and gently grasped one of Dinah's hands. Don't try to talk, she said quietly. If you're awake, Dinah, don't try to talk. Just listen. We're in the air, we're going back, and you're going to be all right. I promise you that. Dinah's hand tightened on hers, and after a moment, Laurel realized the little girl was tugging her forward. She leaned over the secured stretcher. Dinah spoke in a tiny voice that seemed to Laurel a perfect scale model of her former voice.
Don't worry about me, Laurel. I got what I wanted.
Dinah, you shouldn't.
The unseeing brown eyes moved toward the sound of Laurel's voice. A little smile touched Dinah's bloody mouth.
I saw.
That tiny voice, frail as a glass reed, told her.
I saw through Mr. Toomey's eyes. At the beginning, and then again at the end. It was better at the end. At the start, everything looked mean and nasty to him. It was better at the end.
Laurel looked at her with helpless wonder. The girl's hand let go of Laurel's and rose waveringly to touch her cheek.
He wasn't such a bad guy, you know.
She coughed. Small flecks of blood flew from her mouth.
Please, Dinah, Laurel said.
She had a sudden sensation that she could almost see through the little blind girl, and this brought a feeling of stifling, directionless panic. Please don't try to talk anymore.
Dinah smiled.
I saw you,
she said.
You are beautiful, Laurel. Everything was beautiful. Even the things that were dead. It was so wonderful to, you know, just to see.
She drew in one of her tiny sips of air, let it out, and simply didn't take the next one. Her sightless eyes now seemed to be looking far beyond Laurel Stevenson.
Please breathe, Dinah,
Laurel said.
She took the girl's hands in hers and began to kiss them repeatedly, as if she could kiss life back into that which was now beyond it. It was not fair for Dinah to die after she had saved them all. No god could demand such a sacrifice. Not even for people who had somehow stepped outside of time itself.
Please breathe, please, please, please breathe.
But Dinah did not breathe. After a long time, Laurel returned the girl's hands to her lap and looked fixedly into her pale, still face. Laurel waited for her own eyes to fill up with tears, but no tears came.
Yet her heart ached with fierce sorrow, and her mind beat with its own deep and outraged protest.
Oh, no. Oh, not fair. This is not fair. Take it back, God. Take it back, damn you. Take it back. You just take it back.
But God did not take it back. The jet engines throbbed steadily. The sun shone on the bloody sleeve of Dinah's good traveling dress in a bright oblong, and God did not take it back. Laurel looked across the aisle and saw Albert and Bethany kissing. Albert was touching one of the girl's breasts through her T-shirt, lightly, delicately, almost religiously. They seemed to make a ritual shape, a symbolic representation of life in that stubborn, intangible spark which carries life on in the face of the most dreadful reversals and ludicrous turns of fate. Laura looked hopefully from them to Dinah, and God had not taken it back. God had not taken it back. Laurel kissed the still slope of Dinah's cheek and then raised her hand to the little girl's face. Her fingers stopped only an inch from her eyelids.
I saw through Mr. Toomey's eyes. Everything was beautiful, even the things that were dead. It was so wonderful to see. Yes, Laurel said. I can live with that.
She left Dinah's eyes open. American Pride 29 flew west through the days and nights, going from light to darkness and light to darkness, as if flying through a great, lazily shifting parade of fat clouds. Each cycle came slightly faster than the one before. A little over 3 hours into the flight, the clouds below them ceased, and over exactly the same spot where they had begun on the flight east. Brian was willing to bet the front had not moved so much as a single foot. The great plains lay below them in a silent, roan-colored expanse of land.
No sight of them over here,
Rudy Warwick said. He did not have to specify what he was talking about. No, Bob Jenkins agreed. We seem to have outrun them, either in space or in time. Or in both, Albert put in. Yes, or both. But they had not. As Flight 29 crossed the Rockies, they began to see the black lines below them again. Thin as threads from this height. They shot up and down the rough, slabbed slopes and drew not quite meaningless patterns in the blue-gray carpet of trees. Nick stood at the forward door, looking out the bullet porthole set into it. This porthole had a queer magnifying effect, and he soon discovered he could see better than he really wanted to. As he watched, two of the black lines split, raced around a jagged, snow-tipped peak, met on the far side, crossed, and raced down the other slope in diverging directions. Behind them, the entire top of the mountain fell into itself, leaving something which looked like a volcano with a vast, dead caldera at its truncated top.
Jumping Jiminy Jesus, Nick muttered, and passed a quivering hand over his brow.
As they crossed the western slope toward Utah, the dark began to come down again. The setting sun threw an orange-red glare over a fragmented hellscape that none of them could look at for long. One by one, they followed Bethany's example and pulled their window shades. Nick went back to his seat on unsteady legs and dropped his forehead into one cold, clutching hand. After a moment or two, he turned toward Laurel, and she took him wordlessly in her arms. Brian was forced to look at it. There were no shades in the cockpit. Western Colorado and eastern Utah fell into the pit of eternity piece by jagged piece, below him and ahead of him. Mountains, buttes, mesas, and cols, one by one ceased to exist as the crisscrossing langoliers cut them adrift from the rotting fabric of this dead past, cut them loose and sent them tumbling into sunless, endless gulfs of forever. There was no sound up here, and somehow that was the most horrible thing of all. The land below them disappeared as silently as dust motes. Then darkness came, like an act of mercy, and for a little while he could concentrate on the stars. He clung to them with the fierceness of panic, the only real things left in this horrible world. Orion, the hunter, Pegasus, the great shimmering horse of midnight, Cassiopeia in her starry chair.